In John 10, verse 35, a very bold statement is made, and that is that the scripture cannot be broken. In fact, if we understand what God is trying to tell us in the Bible, his word is infallible. The Bible is infallible. It can always be counted on to be truthful. It is a reflection of God's mind in print. And it's an extraordinary book. Some people have been enemies of the Bible, wanted to get rid of it, tried very, very hard. I find it ironic that you would probably never guess which nation in the world prints more Bibles than any other. It's about 100 million per year.
Iran.
China. China, which has a huge persecution waged against a number of different large factions of people in that country. Yes. It makes me think also of Voltaire, the French satirist, who thought that there was no God, thought that the Bible was just a bunch of nonsense. And he didn't want anything to do with the Bible. And yet, after he died, apparently his home ended up being purchased and became a warehouse for Bibles. And so, who had the last word on that? People don't realize how special the Bible is. But we who utilize it in our church services and we study it during the week, hopefully we have a deep and a very reverential, high regard for this book. And it is incredible how the scripture cannot be broken. It is true. And yet there are people that say, no, it's a bunch of nonsense. It's foolish. It's foolishness that we can't rely on. And this has always been the case. There have always been people that were against the Bible, that wanted to burn it. And we saw that in the Middle Ages. If you've read through and seen how there was persecution and a rejection of God's way, it was inspired, of course, by Satan, who has a great deal of hatred for God, his plan for humanity and the like. And he has engendered lies about what God would want to present as truth. Christ said, I am the light and I am the way. And so we realize that God's mind is in print here and that he is the one that is truthful, and that everything we read about in the Bible is true. The promises for us, our protection, for our reliance in him, for knowledge, for the ability to overcome, the ability to endure to the end, to be able to have a future, all of that is predicated on the promises that God gives in his holy book. And his presence makes it holy. I find it very interesting that various archaeologists will go, say, to the Dead Sea Scrolls, for example, written, found in Qumran, that's just on the edge of the Dead Sea. A community there of people, they salvaged and saved various scrolls. And with great awe and reverence, these archaeologists will come and excavate and try to take even the fragments of different scrolls and carry them to a safe place where they can be further studied and maybe be placed in airproof, airtight containers, just like the Declaration of Independence is, so they could be preserved. Usually it's at the Museum of Israel in Jerusalem, but wherever these are discovered, they are handled very, very carefully. Hopefully we have the same approach. And I'd like to talk about the infallibility of the Bible today. I think that we're familiar somewhat, but when we add it all up, it's amazing how we can establish the fact that it is infallible. And we can even go to secular sources to substantiate that. And for people that are critics, people that want to put God down somehow and think that this is just a bunch of malarkey, if they were to be aware of all the ways that secular history and people not connected with any religion, how they have been able to show the infallibility of the Bible, that should really shock society. It should really make people wake up. One of the wake-up calls to certain critics was in 1947, when a shepherd boy was running through the area of Qumran, and he saw a cave off in the distance, and he ran to it, crawled in it, and he noticed that there was this scroll buried by dirt and debris. And he had the sense to go take to other adults that might understand what that was. And they did. And they found that it was a scroll, not the original, but a scroll of the book of Isaiah. And it was in fantastic condition, considering all things. And in a room of maybe a little larger than this, in the Museum of Israel, that scroll exists. And they've opened it up and rolled it out and gone all the way around the room. Now, they figured that that was written about maybe at the 100 AD, 100 BC, somewhere in that area. But Isaiah existed in the 700s. That manuscript at minimum was 700 years old, and it could be much older than that. And what they found was that every letter, every yacht, every tittle that was in the original is in the copy. Meticulous. If you go to Romans 3, you'll see that God entrusted the oracles of God with the Jews. He knew their tenacity, and he knew that they could be entrusted. And the way it operated among the scribes was that if you were to copy a manuscript, and maybe you spent weeks on that manuscript and you had every little letter perfectly painted out, and maybe you sneezed and a little bit of ink landed on that scroll where it didn't belong, you would rip up the entire thing, start all over. It had to be perfect. That is the reverential care that they gave to God's holy word, because they took it literally. In Deuteronomy, it's also mentioned in Revelation. They didn't have the book of Revelation at this point, but the scripture said that whoever would add to or take away from that manuscript would be under a curse. And so again, the Jews that were entrusted with transcribing and writing out the scrolls, they didn't have paper back then the way we do, so the scrolls was the way they preserved the books of the Bible. And it would take a long time to put one scroll together, and that's one of the reasons why they sold for vast amounts of money. Very few people could afford a Bible or even sections of a Bible. They would be happy with that. But it was a meticulous match for Isaiah that the copied Isaiah would be just like the original. And that should give us confidence that it is impossible for God to lie. That's in Hebrews 6:18 and Titus 1 and verse 2. It's impossible. The mind of God is perfect, and he wants to preserve. And again, that what he has preserved is a now book for our day, as we know. And the things that it mentions, we're finding out, archaeology and other people that are investigating the Bible are finding that it is infallible. People used to scoff and say, well, if the Bible were really a now book, you would read about King David. You would read about other major events. There'd be evidence for a flood. There'd be evidence for Sodom and Gomorrah. Where is the evidence? And they think that they can continually say things that are disparaging against God, against his holy book. And so some people have had no compunction about throwing it in the bonfire. It's sad, but we of all people should deeply appreciate and be thankful for the things that we find in history, in secular activity, in archaeological digs that substantiate the Bible. A lot of the arguments that people used to have are disappearing. Back in the 1800s, for example, people that were critics of the Bible would say, well, there's all this to do about Jesus Christ who died, and he died at Golgotha, but there's no evidence around, and that's true. There wasn't until about the 1880s, I think it was. And then somebody discovered the tomb, and it just matched up exactly with what the gospel account said. So it was an inspiration. And there have been many other things like that. Sodom and Gomorrah, for example. People are critical about that. You know, that's maybe a little Bible story you tell your children, but did it really happen? Did a city get wiped out? Is there such a thing as righteous indignation? I have a couple video clips I want to show, and I'll begin with that one. And there are just a lot of amazing things that we are going to look at today. And I don't want to go too fast or too slowly as I do that. But it should give us a deeper appreciation for the book that we carry with us, that we study. So this is first about Sodom. And just looking at it from a scientific point of view, does the Bible make sense?
Can you prove the Bible?
Oh, okay. Turn the lights out. All right.
Oh,
okay. But I thought this was quite interesting.
Gomorrah? People thought it was some fairy tale story made up by the Bible until they actually discovered Sodom and Gomorrah in 1989, about 20 years ago. Not only was it destroyed, it was destroyed by giant balls of sulfur. Now, the Bible says that this was punishment for their sins by great balls of fire. Well, Is there any evidence?
Ignore this. I forgot about that.
This is the city of Sodom, and you can see evidence of a thriving city with temples and statues dedicated to their gods. There were ziggurats and temples of prostitution, and the buildings were pretty much melted down, as evidenced by thermal ionization, indicating heating up to 6,000 degrees. This happened because particles of sulfur and ash hit the city, as evidenced by these impact marks. The black center indicates the burn. Sometimes you'll see white sulfur in the middle. So you can imagine how these can catch on fire and literally rain fire and brimstone, as the Bible describes. These sulfur brimstones are found all over the city. Laboratory analysis of the sulfur indicates that it's monoclinic, white sulfur that's been cooked in a high temperature, which is different from geothermal sulfur. The sulfur was found to be 98% pure sulfur, unlike any naturally occurring sulfur on Earth.
98.4.
You can't explain this naturally or through some volcanic activity. So the best possible other theory is maybe there was a meteor shower? Yeah, which just happens to destroy a major pagan city dedicated to sin. Seriously? I think it takes more faith to believe in a meteor shower than to believe in the Bible. At least the Bible has proof. They found Jericho. They found Gilgal, Shechem, Dan, Megiddo, Beersheba. In 1906, they found the Hittites in Ankara, Turkey. They found artifacts that confirmed the stories in the Bible. The Moabite stone, Shishak's invasion of Judah, Shalmaneser III, King Uzziah, Hezekiah, Sennacherib. I could go on for an hour.
Okay. All right, that just shows that there is some pushback against all the ridicule and the discrediting of the Bible itself. And another controversy is over Noah's Ark. I'm just not going to play video of that argument, but simply say that there have been different people that have claimed to have seen the Ark, and one was a friend of mine. His name was Oscar Wolf, and he was a church member. He was a deacon in the Fort Myers congregation. He said that when he was in Turkey, stationed in the military at an air base with a reconnaissance aircraft coming and going, he said that he was able to photograph Noah's Ark. He said it's not on top of the mountain. It's about halfway up, 7,000-foot level. And perhaps what he said coincides with what some others have claimed, that an earthquake or some force had snap the ark into two sections. It's amazing how many people will lie or exaggerate and cover and make statements they cannot substantiate. I read where one critic was frustrated and said, it seems like everybody that goes up to Noah's Ark or Mount Ararat, where it sits, is they go to different locations and they all claim to find it. And so somebody's not telling the truth. But I believed my deacon friend when he said that he saw that. And he wanted to print out high-resolution photographs. And his commanding officer thought that would be insane. He was anti-Bible. And so he nixed it. And so that all ended up in the trash basket. And it may be that God allows that on purpose, because ultimately the just shall live by faith. And there are some things that may only become apparent at the return of Christ or thereafter. But there are certainly a number of things before then. There was a book that came out, In Search of Noah's Ark. That was in the mid-70s. And it quoted a number of people, including the Tsar of Russia, who claimed that he sent part of an army up to Mount Ararat, and they found the ark, that it wasn't that hard to get to because the it wasn't buried by ice, as it apparently is now. Let's shift gears here and talk about the miracle of the prophecies of Jesus Christ. As you know, there are different prophecies in the Old Testament that were written in 500 BC, 800 BC, 1000 BC, different times. And those particular prophecies talked about Christ living and dying in approximately 31 AD. So, can anybody think of any prophecies in the Old Testament that predicted some aspect of Christ's crucifixion? Maybe you've never thought of that, but can anybody think of anything in the Old Testament that was fulfilled by the death of Jesus Christ? Yes. I think you're right. Yes. There's some additional things in the book of Psalms. But
one prophecy that states he would be disfigured beyond human comprehension.
Yeah, anybody know where that is?
Isaiah
53. Yes. We cover that every Passover service. Any other prophecies?
They would.
Paul, and then we'll go back.
They would gamble for his garments.
That's right. Psalm 22. Barbara?
Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6 predicts his birth and his reign.
Okay.
They would ride in on a donkey.
That's right. Come in on a donkey. Be born in Bethlehem. That's Micah 5, verse 2. Mm-hmm. And then what was yours? Yes.
And first one in Genesis, that God, you know, when he proclaimed to the serpent that the woman's son shall crush your head.
Yes, Genesis 3:15. Yeah. And then there are a number of others. One, that he would be born of a virgin.
Right, yeah.
So that's in Isaiah. And Isaiah was written maybe in the 700s B.C., And here we're reading about Christ's sacrifice. Is that lucky guesswork? No. No. In Psalm 22, well, let's turn to some of these. Psalm 22. And several of you named different incidents that occurred here. One of the most significant is verse 1, where David wrote, we think it's David here, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And of course, Christ used that, quoted that verse, and it was a question which echoes down to our time. It's a very penetrating question. And that was that he wanted to make the impression on mankind that the reason why God had to forsake him was that he was now the epitome of all sin. He represented all sin. And sin separates God from his creation. And so when Christ died, he felt, or just at this point, just before he died, he felt the lack of contact with God the Father. It was probably one of the most severe trials that he would ever face, feeling abandoned, because he then assumed the responsibility of the sin that occurred in this world. And so this was a quote from the Old Testament. Also, it says in verse 16, they pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. They look and stare at me. Verse 17, and they divide my garments up among them. And for my clothing, they cast lots. So we see some incredible statements. And the Psalms were written at least 1,000 years before Christ lived, maybe earlier. And yet it is exact. It's fulfilled. Another one. Christ was sold for 30 pieces of silver. And that was predicted in the book of Zechariah. And so you, a number of other points you were accurate on. So the Psalms, Isaiah, Zechariah, Micah wrote information that became true. Let's go on to another area. Is there any secular historical evidence for the 10 plagues of Egypt? Think about it. 10 plagues of Egypt. That didn't happen in a corner, if it really occurred, because those plagues crippled the nation, according to the Bible, brought the people to their knees practically. And so they were telling the Israelites, here, take my gold and my silver and everything, you know, just head on out, leave us alone. And so is there any extra biblical evidence that the 10 plagues of Egypt ever existed? Because a lot of critics would say, you know, you don't hear about it. There aren't books in the libraries that say, here's what happened. Are there? And so people think, well, it couldn't have happened. It's preposterous. It's an incredible figment of somebody's imagination. You know, the frogs on the loose, crippling a country, water of the Nile turning to blood. You know, when's that ever happened? That doesn't happen. But in the early 19th century, a papyrus dating back to the end of the Middle Kingdom was found in Egypt. It was taken to the Leiden Museum in Holland and interpreted by an A.H. Gardiner in 1909. The complete papyrus can be found in the book Admonitions of an Egyptian from an heretic papyrus in Leiden. The papyrus described the violent upheavals in Egypt, starvation, drought, escape of slaves with the wealth of the Egyptians, and death throughout the land. The papyrus was written by an Egyptian named Ibuwer, I-B-U-W-E-R, and appears to be an eyewitness account of the effects of the Exodus plagues from the perspective of an average Egyptian. Below are excerpts of the papyrus together with their parallels in the Bible for the plagues and the Exodus. I don't have time to read it all, but I'll just highlight very, very quickly. We know that the first plague to come was the water turning to blood in Egypt. According to the Ipurer papyrus, it says the plague is throughout the land. Blood is everywhere. And then he goes on, the river is blood. Men shrink from tasting human beings and thirst after water. They're just all out desperation. The Bible says there was blood throughout the land of Egypt and the river stank. So that's where I meant. Men shrink from tasting, not human beings. That's a separate thought. Human beings thirst after water. Okay, chapter 3, or 7, verse 24. And the Egyptians dug around the river for water to drink, but they could not drink the water of the river. And that's in the Bible, in this papyrus. It says, that is our water. That is our happiness. What shall we do in respect thereof? All is ruin. Now, plague number 2 talked about, or at least this isn't the second plague, but this chapter 9, verse 23 and 24 of Exodus. And the fire ran along the ground, and there was hail, and fire mingled with the hail. It was very grievous. And the hail smote every herb of the field and broke every tree of the field. I'll go over to the papyrus. Lower Egypt weeps. The entire palace is without its revenues. To it belongs wheat, barley, geese, and fish. And for the grain has perished on every side. And what was perished yesterday is left over to us now. I won't take the time, but every different plague of Egypt has a counterpart in this secular history. So we saw where there was blood, there was frogs that harassed the country, lice, flies, cattle, boils, hail. All this has a secular counterpart. And then the death of the firstborn, and the fact that it was so dark. You know, God rubbed their noses in it, because all of these different factors, the frogs, the lice, the flies, the hail, the darkness, was a put down of the false gods of Egypt. They worshipped, apparently, variations of frogs. They worshipped the sun. And when the sun, and when the everything turned black, then that was an affront against Ra, the sun god. And the people were given the opportunity to conclude the obvious, that these false gods were that. They were false. And they could not deliver the Egyptians. And at the end, the Bible talks in chapter 12 of Exodus, and they requested from the Egyptians silver and gold articles and clothing, and made the Egyptians favor them, and they granted their requests. Thus, they drained Egypt of its wealth. It wasn't just taking a few gold coins. They really stripped the country. This is something that's not taught in schools, but according to the secular history, it says gold and lapis, silver and carnelian and bronze are fastened onto the neck of a female and taken away. So these are archaeological digs or discoveries that really reveal some amazing coincidences. Let's now walk through some of the great discoveries of the Bible that help substantiate the fact that it is infallible, that the scripture cannot be broken, that God does not lie. In 1799, for example, was the discovery of the Rosetta Stone. That does not have a direct implication with the Bible, except in a roundabout way. The Rosetta Stone, one of the most famous finds, was written in Egyptian and Greek. So people, scholars, could read one and the other, and they could understand the languages of the time. And then they could take that knowledge and read hieroglyphics, eventually in other languages, and understand from multiple sources, secular sources, what was going on. But the key to that was to understand these different stones. And there were other times when there would be cylinders of stone with lots of writing etched out on it that would talk about the history of the countries, or aspirations of leaders. And so there are other stones that were tremendously helpful. Let's say you did not know Egyptian, but you knew Greek. and you could line them up side by side, eventually you could think, oh, okay, I see what these Egyptian words mean because I've got the thing in Greek. So this was a huge breakthrough in archaeology, that when they were able to break through various codes or secrets, they were able to understand finally in other languages what happened in life. That was huge. After that, the next huge discovery was the Taylor Prison, 1839. And this was all about something that Isaiah wrote about. And that was, and also the King's Chronicles, the Taylor Prison talked about Sennacherib, who was a primary leader in Assyria. Remember, according to Isaiah 10, verse 5, Assyria is spanks Israel, and God views Assyria as the rod of mine anger. And so at a different time, the Assyrians were invading, and they would come in one wave after another. Sargon II was one leader, and Shalmaneser was another. And then it came down to Sennacherib, a military man. And so he had a huge group of forces that came and surrounded Jerusalem and about 45 other little towns. One was Lachish. And I remember reading with Lachish, they were communicating with the people in Jerusalem. If Jerusalem were here, Lachish was over here, and there was this narrow swath that had not yet been taken over by the Assyrians. And so the people at Lachish were saying, we can't hold out too much longer. The Assyrians are going to sweep through and take us. Well, more important than whether they did or not was the fact that here the secular history is describing events that were discussed in the Bible. Hezekiah was afraid for his life and for his country, and was praying his heart out that God would intervene. And apparently God did, because 185,000 Assyrian troops were killed in one night. That's the Bible talks about that. Now, what does secular history say? It doesn't say that God wiped out 185,000. But in the writings that we see of the Assyrians, the king said, I surrounded Jerusalem and my mighty army surrounded Lachish, and I had Hezekiah like a bird in a cage. But he never said that he took over Jerusalem, did he? Doesn't talk about what happened to his army. It'd be pretty embarrassing to walk back to home office and say, I can't tell you where 185,000 people are. But don't go down to Judah. No. The prism that was discovered explained what had happened. There was a Moabite stone that was founded in 1868, and there's reference to King Omni of Israel and his son Ahab. Here's another one, 2 Chronicles 32, verse 30. And I should have mentioned this before. And this is where Hezekiah was again under siege, and he thought, how are we going to hold out? And so he said, we are going to redirect the water. The water that comes to the king's gardens on the east side of the city of Jerusalem, the water is for everybody. But now that the Assyrians are among us, he decided to reroute the water, and so that it would go back. It would come out of the ground inside the city gates and go back into the ground before it got outside the city gates. He said, why should we allow our enemies to drink of the water here? But the water would be rerouted, and it was going to be managed by a tunnel that was going to be dug underground. We're going to look at pictures of that tunnel. It's called Hezekiah's Tunnel, and it really did happen. and people didn't know that it happened. They knew it was mentioned in the Bible. Let's turn there, 2 Chronicles 32. 2 Chronicles 32, verse 30. Chapter 32, verse 30. And these pages are 32, verse 30. Sorry. Okay, this same Hezekiah also stopped the water outlet of Upper Gihon. That would be in the southeast corner of Jerusalem, where there's a hill. He stopped up the water in Upper Gihon and brought the water by tunnel to the west side of the city of David. So let's have a look at that. It's about 2 minutes long.
And when Hezekiah saw that Sennacherib was coming, and that he was determined to fight against Jerusalem, he took counsel with his princes and his mighty men to stop the waters of the springs which were outside the city, and they did help him. So there gathered a large group of people together, and they stopped up all the springs in the brook that ran through the midst of the land, saying, "Why should the kings of Assyria come and find much water?"
Spring. It contains an enormous amount of water.
Prior to Hezekiah's rule, all this water flowed outside the city through irrigation channels to the fields of the people and to the king's gardens.
When he prepared Jerusalem for the Assyrian siege, Hezekiah worried that the mighty army of Assyria would camp outside the city walls, gaining access to the city's water source.
He decided to prevent their use of the water by blocking and sealing the springs outside the city, including the Gihon spring. He diverted the spring's water into an underground tunnel, which had been quarried into the heart of the mountain. Two groups of masons worked towards each other from both sides and met in the middle of the tunnel. And the water flowed from the source to the pool. The tunnel ends at the pool of Siloam, which was inside the city, behind protective walls. The account of this engineering wonder is mentioned explicitly in the Bible and is also documented in the Shiloah inscription, which was discovered 6 meters from the end of the tunnel.
This is a copy of the inscription written in ancient Hebrew letters. It describes the dramatic moment when the two groups met inside the tunnel.
The masons were swinging their axes one towards the other, and they heard the voice of one man calling his fellow. And on the day of the tunneling, the masons bore through, one man towards his fellow, axe upon axe, and the water flowed from the source to the pool for 1,200 cubits.
Kind of amazing, huh? So that silenced the critics that thought that that was a bogus or just insane claim to make, that the tunnel was constructed underneath the city. It's interesting that when Isaiah may have his burial might have been in this one particular area, there was a ring or a signet that was worn that was the same that Hezekiah had. And I should, not the body of Isaiah, but the seal of Isaiah was found 10 feet from the seal of Hezekiah. One other thing about Isaiah, he predicted the fall of Babylon, and he predicted that a man by the name of Cyrus would be responsible for that. The thing was, Cyrus lived 150 years after Hezekiah died. Was that just a lucky guess that somebody would write about another person that would emerge 150 years later and know the person's name and know that that same person would capture the city of Babylon and that they would dry up the river Euphrates to do it? That's what happened, is that Cyrus, in order to take the city rerouted the water, and the River Euphrates then flowed elsewhere. And so the water that would normally go through the city of Jerusalem just dropped lower and lower, and they had these iron gates that would be impossible to get through because of all the water. But now that it was gone, you could walk underneath the bottom of the gate unobstructed. And if you read Daniel 5, there was an orgy that was going on the final day of the freedom of the Babylonians. And they didn't know that while they were getting drunk, the people in the army of Cyrus were infiltrating the city. And they took it over that night. The Bible talks about this in Isaiah 44 and 45. So we'll take a look at that. And when Cyrus came to the city, eventually he met the Jews and was quite impressed to read in their holy book that his name was mentioned. And maybe it was because of that he did two things. One, he gave freedom to all the Jews that wanted to go back to Jerusalem to help rebuild the temple. And let's see, Isaiah 44. And then he, of course, described how the nation of Babylon would collapse that very night. At the end of chapter 44, it says in verse 26, "And I will raise up her waste places," now to verse 27, "who says to the deep, be dry, to the river, be dry, and I will dry up your rivers. Who says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd." In other words, not that he was converted, but that he was a tool that God used in order to transition from Babylon to the next empire, which would be Medo-Persia. "Who says of Cyrus," verse 28, "he is my shepherd, and he shall perform all my pleasure, saying to Jerusalem, you shall be built." And that's what he agreed to do. "And to the temple, your foundation shall be laid." Now, this continues in the next chapter. There were no chapter breaks in the original manuscripts. Verse 45, verse 1 of chapter 45, though. "Thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have held, to subdue nations before him and loose the armor of kings, and to open before him the double doors, so that the gate will not be shut." Now, this part people understood because if you go to Berlin at the Pergamon Museum, you will see the entrance of Babylon. Wait a minute, it was in Babylon, right? No, archaeologists took the entire Ishtar Gate with the double doors. They took at least the bricks that made up the entrance. Brick by brick back to Berlin. And they were meticulous in doing that. And then they reassembled the entire thing. We've been there. It's an inspiration. Color is blue, and there are these orange lions every so often. You can go to any commentary. You can look it up online. You can see the appearance of the Ishtar Gate in the Pergamon Museum. And it's just helped substantiate what Isaiah predicted hundreds of years before. That's not lucky guesswork. The Bible is, you know, "Thy word is truth," John 17:17. God cannot lie. If he says that these things are going to be, then they're going to be. Now, some things God predicts in the future, and it's conditional. But there are other things that have happened, and there is proof of that. I've got to move along here. In 1879, there was a Cyrus cylinder. It's in the British Museum, but same thing. You had history in written in hieroglyphics or the equivalent carved out on stone. People used to ridicule, it's interesting, maybe it was Satan inspired, the fact Pontius Pilate doesn't exist. In 1961, though, there was an inscription of Pontius Pilate that was located in Caesarea. Caesarea is a Roman town fortress that was built on the edge of the Mediterranean Sea. So in 1961, that claim was shot to pieces, that there was no such thing as Pilate. In 1993, there was an Armenian king that bragged about defeating the king of Israel, Jeroboam. And also in 93, that was an important year in archaeology. There was no evidence of King David. And there are reasons for that that I won't get into. But in 1993, there was a key find at Tel Dan. And the phrase that was placed on one of the stones there was, quote, from the house of David. And in 1 Kings 12:18, don't turn there, that phrase, from the house of David, seems to be a common phrase. And in 2004, the Pool of Siloam, which you saw in this video, was discovered. Of course, the Bible has a lot to say about that in the book of John, but it wasn't the case. Now let's shift gears again. I'm going to read the names of six people. Pliny the Younger, they call him the Younger instead of Junior. Pliny the Younger, Josephus, Segundus, Phlegon, Mar Serapton, and Suetonius. Those are six eyewitness historians to Jesus Christ's life. For people to say, well, how do we know where he came from? How do we know that there was any independent way to substantiate it? These people wrote about it. Some were favorable to Christ, others disliked him. But they all wrote observations about him. I'll just move to read what two of them wrote. One was Tacitus in his book, The Annals. And he writes about Christ this way. He's a senator, was a senator and historian of the Roman Empire. And he referred to Christ in a work that he called The Annals in 116 AD. On one page, he described the execution of Christus, that's Christ, by Pontius Pilate, and provides one of the earliest non-biblical accounts of Christians. Quote, consequently, to get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and infliction of the most exquisite tortures on a class hatred for their abominations called Christians. A little bias, I'd say. And Christus, from whom the name had its origin by the populace, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate, and a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of evil, but in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world seemed to find their a center and become popular. I'm not defending everything as being written, but that's the context. But he doesn't put Christ in a very positive light, but he does recognize that he existed and he faced Pontius Pilate. Another classic account is from Josephus, and he writes that the Roman procurator Pontius Pilate examined him. And Jesus, a wise man, if one should call him a man, for he was the one who performed surprising deeds and was a teacher of such people as accept the truth gladly. He won over many Jews and many of the Greeks. He was the Messiah. And when, upon the accusation of the principal men among us, Pilate had condemned him to a cross, those who had come first to love him did not cease. He appeared to them, spending a third day restored to life, for the prophets of God had foretold these things and 1,000 other marvels about him. And the tribe of the Christians, so called after him, has still to this day not disappeared. So there is extra biblical evidence that the things that the Bible talks about did occur. We've talked in the past about Bible prophecy. We've talked about the United States and the British Commonwealth and Bible prophecy. And I did a couple sermons here, and I talked about, amazingly, you know, here we are thousands of years removed from our ancestry. You see, you can look at many people and say, where are your ancestors from? Well, they're from Europe. Well, some are from Asia, South America, but most of them in years gone by would say Europe. Where were they from before Europe? Well, Eastern Europe. Where do they come from before that? Scythian Empire, between China and East Europe. Where were they before the Scythian Empire? They were in the foothills of the Balkan countries. Or they were then whereabouts before that? And before Turkey, Assyrian as captives, or Babylonians as captives. Where were they before that? Palestine, Middle East. They were the Israelites. Or you could work it from there all the way up to the current time. And it's astonishing that the United States has this Jewish or Israelitish book, the Bible. You know, why would we have so many of them? Isn't it unusual that on the U.S. dollar bill, you've got the Star of David, I've pointed that out with the 13 stars, and 13 appearing in many different forms on the dollar bill, which coincides with the 13 tribes of Israel. Isn't it interesting that there's a pyramid on our currency, on the $1 bill, as if to acknowledge our ancestry came back from Egypt. They were slaves in Egypt. And Ben Franklin and a few others, when the dollar bill was going to be devised, they wanted, let me take that back. The dollar bill that we use came later, but the seal of the United States that would appear on the dollar bills eventually, Ben Franklin and several others wanted that to be not a pyramid, but the Israelites coming out of Egypt crossing the Red Sea. That was going to be the inscription. There's a prophecy in the Bible about possessing the sea gates of their enemies in the book of Genesis. Genesis 35 verse 11 talks about a nation and the company of nations, and that they would have the sea gates. And that's also in Genesis 48:49. Bottom line with this is that it did happen. And what are the odds it would happen? What would it be the odds of two nations that were brothers, that may have their squabbles, occupying the Suez Canal, the Panama Canal, Strait of Gibraltar, Strait of Malacca, English Channel, and Cape of Good Hope, Cape Horn, and Hawaii, Guam, the Philippines, Virgin Islands, and a few other places. It just doesn't happen. And it's more than lucky guesswork. There is a God that does exist, and his Bible is infallible. Whether it's prophesying things about this country or events that happened with ancient Assyria or whatever, the scripture cannot be broken. It is an absolute blessing for us because we need to trust in this book. It has the answers for all the needs that we have. It has answers for what we face in the future. When it says in many different places, do not be afraid. We don't know what's coming, but a lot of God's people in the past didn't know either. And they lived in danger at times, and God saw them through, and they always trusted in him. It's an unfathomable blessing that we have, that we need to be appreciative of, that we need to be in awe of. When we look at archaeological projects, a friend of mine was at a symposium one time, and they were discussing the fall of Jericho. Could that have really happened, and the walls falling down? And when you understand the city, there was a wall of bricks, basically, and that made up a huge base. And then there was a second layer of dirt and debris and maybe some bricks. I forget where that began and ended. And then there was a third tier. And during the, and the evidence is that with the earthquake and the shouting and the blaring of trumpets, that the walls fell out. And the top walls fell. The base was there. And it says that the Israelites ran up into the city. And it makes perfect sense when you understand how the different parts of the walls and various segments collapsed and made a mound that they had to go up over instead of across and up and over. So in its minute details, the Bible is incredible. And there are other digs. There are other things that I don't have time to get into. But we need to know that the Bible is worth trusting, worth counting on, that God doesn't lie. Otherwise, how could we face the future? How could we ever feel comfortable about things? But when we see evidence of major events happening, and I'm doing surgery here to end on time, it's just astonishing. We can talk about this after the potluck, but it's encouraging to me to know that God is all-powerful and his word is true. And what he prophesies, he'll bring to pass. What he promises you or myself, if we'll maybe attain to certain conditions, then that will be a blessing. So we can be extremely thankful that we carry a special book with us, one that has the answers to everything and can tell us in the past what happened that was of any great significance. Let's be glad for the infallibility of the Bible.
Get all that, Joey? You get all that?
Yeah.